It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Anoush Zamarodi. And on the show today, what topples democracies? And for our final guest, something a little different. A conversation we recorded live at TED's first democracy event held in New York City this month. I was joined on stage by political scientist Yasha Monk to talk about the wave of authoritarian leadership around the world and how the ideals of democracy that many of us have taken for granted are changing in surprising ways. So just a little bit about Yasha. He was born in Germany to Jewish parents who had immigrated from Poland. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins. He became a U.S. citizen in 2017 and has written 5 books about the state of democracy. Here we are on the TED stage. You were one of the first to start alerting us that liberal democracies had big problems when you wrote in July 2016, "The citizens of wealthy established democracies are less satisfied with their governments than they have been at any time since opinion polling began." With that as the backdrop, I actually want to start somewhere positive. Let's start with Poland. The Democratic Opposition Party won recent elections there. It's being called a win for liberal democracies everywhere. Remind us about what happened and how you see it.
Yeah, Poland is a wonderful microcosm of both a threat to democracy in this moment and the fact that we shouldn't need to despair. You know, when I was in graduate school, my professors taught me it's very hard to sustain democracies. But once countries have had a number of changes of government for free and fair elections, once they reach a certain level of wealth, you basically can take the future of democracy for granted. And Poland was one of those places. But then what we saw is something that wasn't supposed to happen. These political candidates and parties come into government that are very extreme, that don't respect the basic rules of a democratic game, but try to concentrate power in their own hands. And we call them populists. Populists like Donald Trump in the United States, like Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and like the ruling Law and Justice Party in Poland that won in 2015 and was in charge for a very long time. And it looked as though they had managed to concentrate power in their own hands. They had turned the state broadcaster into a propaganda outlet. They had replaced many of the justices on the country's courts. But what we've also seen is that democratic oppositions can be resilient even in the face of these challenges, even as the ability to organize as an opposition becomes more and more constrained. And about a month ago in Poland, that democratic opposition managed to remove the government by democratic means. They managed, against the odds, against all of those challenges, to win a contested democratic election. And it now looks as though Poland is back on the path towards a more stable democratic system.
And so, yes, you can return to democracy, but it won't necessarily be a smooth path.
Well, so the problem is that once you have people in the democratic system who really don't play by the democratic rules, it sets up all of those follow-on dilemmas. So one of the things that the incoming government will now have to decide to do is what you do once the state broadcaster is full of loyalists of the outgoing government who really just spread the most extreme form of propaganda. Well, I guess you want to fire all of them. But if you fire all of them, then you're just another step in the repoliticization of the state broadcaster. That's not going to be the way to actually turn it into a neutral and trusted source. What do you do when a lot of the justices on the courts have been appointed in an illegitimate manner? But if you then go and fire all of the justices, you're simply cementing a new norm that each time that somebody wins an election, you're going to come in and sweep out the old people and politicize the system. And that's not the way to build stable institutions. So I think we've been thinking far too much in the last 10 years. You're either full democracy or you're veering towards full dictatorship. I think the actual situation we're going to be facing is, you know, decades of struggle over those things. in which we might make a little bit of progress in one moment, in which more democratic forces might win an election, and trying to reestablish some of those basic democratic rules, and in which the populists win sometimes and start to undermine those rules. And we're never going to have a perfect democracy. Most countries will never turn into straight-up dictatorships. We'll be somewhere in that messy middle. And so I think what we're facing is a very long and protracted and complicated fight.
So all the countries that you mentioned, the threats to their democracies were different. But for our purposes, you often use the term liberal democracy. Can we just define that, how you see it?
Yeah, so as a political scientist, I think of our political system as having two fundamental values. So I tend to use the term liberal democracy, which is that one value of our democracy is derived from the literal meaning of a term. Democracy is the rule of the people. It's the idea that we collectively rule ourselves rather than having a king or a military general or a priest or a rabbi or an imam or somebody else telling us what to do. But that's not the only thing, because we also think that even the majority should not be able to tell us exactly how to live. But even if the majority says, we don't like what you say, they shouldn't be allowed to shut us up. Even if the majority says, we don't like the way you worship, they shouldn't be allowed to force us to worship in the way that they worship. And so this is the second element, the liberal element, the republican element, the element that maintains our individual freedom. And the danger with many of these authoritarian politicians, many of what you might call these populists, is that they don't want to accept that. But they say, I and I alone truly represent the people. And if you disagree with me, then you're illegitimate, then there's something wrong with you. And so that becomes a threat to the pluralism we need in our political system to sustain individual liberty.
Okay, so these two core components, you've got the individual rights and the popular will. When do you start to see those fracture?
Well, so I think there's two ways that that can happen. One is that sometimes established political parties and movements stop being good at listening to what people actually want, right? They often come from a similar kind of social milieu. They have their own kind of ideas and values. They're often more affluent, so they might have their own kinds of material interests as well. And so often they stop being very good at translating the popular will into public policy. But that then invites a counter reaction. That invites politicians who come in and say, you shouldn't trust those elites, you shouldn't trust the people in charge. They're completely corrupt and self-interested. They don't want to listen to you. They look down on you. And so what we need is somebody who truly speaks for the people. And that's me. I truly am the voice of the people. And all you need to do is to allow me to go in government to push aside all of these stupid norms and procedures that constrain what the people actually want. And that way we're going to make progress. And that is the thing that all of these politicians that otherwise look very dissimilar to each other have in common. Why, as political scientists, do we talk about authoritarian populists like Donald Trump and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and Recep Erdogan in Turkey and Viktor Orban in Hungary and Narendra Modi in India? These politicians come from very different parts of the world. They come from different parts of the political spectrum. Some of them are left-wing, many of them are right-wing. They have different religions. They hate different kinds of people. They all hate somebody. They hate different kinds of people, though. What they have in common is this claim that they truly represent the voice of their country, and that anybody who disagrees with them is not just a political opponent, but an enemy, somebody who's illegitimate because they disagree with them.
Okay, we're entering 2024, which is a mega election year. My understanding is 2 billion voters are expected to go to the polls in 50-plus countries. Broadly speaking, is this next year a tipping point or a key moment for democracy that you're watching?
Yes, there will be a number of very important elections. And, you know, one of the most important ones will be in the United States. But we got quite lucky in the first term of Donald Trump because he did not have a deep bench of loyalists who were competent and who actually wanted to effectuate his program, because there was real constraints on him from within his own political party. All of that is going to be different the next time around. He now is coming in with a much more decided plan to push back against any of the limits on his power. He's in a much angrier mood. He has many more loyalists who've actually spent 4 years gaining experience about how to wrangle a federal bureaucracy and how to exercise the levers of power. And it looks like we're going to be in much more existential international crises as well. That alone makes 2024 a decisive year for democracy in the United States and by implication around the world.
So you just talked about how Donald Trump has changed in the past 4 years, but what about the electorate? One thing you wrote was that knowing what ethnic group a voter hails from tells you less about who they are going to vote for today than it did in 2016. Talk about what's changed for voters.
Yeah, I've been worried about the crisis of democracy since before it was cool. But at some point, when people still, in very significant numbers, seem to plan to vote for him, we need to look in the mirror a little bit. It's not that Americans love Donald Trump so much. According to most polls, they actually don't. It's that they also kind of hate the people on the other side. And so I think those of us who are really worried about Trump should think a little bit about why we can't convince people of the danger he poses. And I think one of the key things that many Americans have gotten wrong, especially political consultants and politicians and so on, is this idea of a rising demographic majority for Democrats or for the left. White voters tend to prefer Republicans, and non-white voters tend to prefer the Democratic Party. And so as the share of non-white voters increases, there's going to be this natural majority for Democrats. In 2016, knowing what race somebody belongs to in the United States gave you a lot of information about who they were going to vote for. By 2020, that was already the case to a much lesser degree. And when we're looking at the polls now, that trend seems to have accelerated more. So, for example, among Hispanic voters, Donald Trump is now within single digits of Joe Biden. There's a very, very close election coming up, even if you just look at Hispanic voters. And it turns out that many Latino voters also have concerns about immigration. It turns out that many African-American voters, many Muslim voters have concerns about what children are taught in schools when it comes to sexual education and gender questions and so on. The other way to explain this is to look at the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has effectively become the political party of educated elites, of people who have college degrees. It speaks like somebody who's just graduated from one of the universities at which I teach. Most people don't talk like that. Most voters continue not to have a college degree. And so if you turn yourself into the party of a highly educated, you lose elections.
Well, we're all sitting here together talking the same way. As a member of the press, I've certainly heard just in the last few days, loud and clear, Margaret Sullivan wrote an op-ed calling the press out for writing in very sanitized language about autocratic plans that the would-be again president is making if he were to take office. That was, in fact, very sanitized language that I just used to describe that. And it makes me wonder what the heck we should do.
America is a very affluent country with very lively civil society organizations, with very independent-minded media, with a deeply regional system of governance, with many checks on political power. Would a second Trump turn be an acute danger to American democracy? Yes, absolutely. I think January 6, 2021 demonstrates that very clearly. Would that mean that the moment he's elected, you know, we should give up on American democracy? No, of course not. You know, there's this idea in American politics of what some people call the beer test. In the 2004 presidential election campaign, there was a poll which showed that many more Americans would like to have a beer with George W. Bush than with John Kerry. And so when the media didn't understand why George W. Bush won re-election, people said, well, perhaps it's because people wanted to have a beer with George W. Bush. I don't think that makes sense, because most voters know that they're never going to have a beer with a president. Why should they care? But I think there's an inverse beer test that makes a lot more sense. I think a lot of voters ask themselves, you know, if this political candidate showed up in my home today and I didn't have time to clean up, right? I was going to talk to them the way I talk to my friends or to my neighbors. Are they going to like me? Are they going to respect me? Or are they going to look down on me? And I think that's the test that pro-democratic forces fail far too often.
I do want to just finish by asking you, you wrote that, this really struck me what you wrote. You said there's nothing natural about the idea of a nation. And, you know, I think this is what we're born into, and sometimes we forget just how strange and radical and even experimental it is.
We all have subnational identities, right? We have allegiances to the cultural origin of our parents, allegiances to the religion we might practice, religions to our ethnic groups, and all of that is fine. But in order to sustain that incredible scheme of social cooperation, we also have to lean into some of the identities that we share. We also have to recognize that above and beyond those things, we have things in common as residents of the same city or as citizens of the same country or the same nation. You know, as a German Jew, it is true that patriotism does not come naturally to me, right? But I have over time come to embrace the idea of patriotism, not in its ethnic variant, but in the civic sense. Part of a healthy patriotism is an appreciation and a love for the culture of your country. It is a love of the sights and sounds and smells and cities and landscapes and people that animate the country today. And that lived, forward-looking culture of a country like the United States bears the influence and the hallmarks of people from very different backgrounds, very different origins, very different cultural and religious groups. And I think having a healthy love for that is one of the things that can connect us to each other and allow us to have forbearance for each other, to tolerate each other when we get on each other's nerves, and hopefully to stand arm in arm to build a better future.
That was Yascha Mounk. He's a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is The Identity Trap, a story of ideas and power in our time. Thank you so much for listening to our show about democracy. This episode was produced by Andrea Gutierrez, Fiona Guerin, Rachel Faulkner-White, Chloe Weiner, and Harsha Nahada. It was edited by Sanaz Meshkinpour, James Delahousie, and me. Our production staff at NPR also includes Katie Monteleone and Matthew Cloutier. Irene Noguchi is our executive producer. Our audio engineers were Josh Newell, Robert Rodriguez, and Gilly Moon. Our theme music was written by Ramtin Arablouei. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Michelle Quint, Alejandra Salazar, and Daniela Balarezzo. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you've been listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.